and shattered to pieces. While he was in Jabalia refugee camp, the Israelis perpetrated a massacre in Jabalia, which was 70 meters away from where he was. He twice escaped death. And his son is an American-born citizen. They, along with the rest of the family, finally got clearance to be able to leave Rafah to go elsewhere. And as they were fleeing from the heavily bombed northern part of the Gaza Strip, they were forced to go through a checkpoint, what was supposed to be a safe passage on Salah ad-Din Road, which is the road that leads from the north to the south. At that checkpoint, at that military area, he, along with hundreds of other people, were forced to raise their hands. He was forced to put his son down on the ground, his young son, 3 years old, raise his hands in the air. And he and hundreds of others, men and women, this has been confirmed by his wife, were then abducted. They weren't arrested. They were abducted, kidnapped by the Israeli army, with everybody else told to continue on. His family is not in Rafah. They are still trying to get to the south. It is near impossible to get to the south. And his family still has not heard from him. They have no idea of his whereabouts. We've checked everywhere with the ICRC, with representatives of Congress, with the State Department, and nobody has been able to provide us with even the simplest of answers in terms of where he is, why he's been abducted, what conditions he's being held under, and when it is that he will be released. And this is why so many are pushing and demanding not only for Mus'ab's release, but for the release of the hundreds of Palestinians that Israel has abducted over the course of the past 7 weeks.
I'm wondering, you've commented in the past on the extent to which Israel has been disseminating false information about the war. Could you elaborate on what's been the effects of that?
Well, the effect has been that we now see that commercial media are looking and examining the tiny little minutia of disinformation that Israel is putting out, but they seem to ignore the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that Israel is bombing a 2.2 million populated refugee camp. Half of them are children. And we just keep hearing one piece of disinformation after another. We've heard them talk about the legality of bombing hospitals when anybody who has any sense of morality or notion of what's legal, what's right, knows that you can't bomb a hospital. And yet, rather than questioning that, we've seen instead that commercial media have been going down the path of simply accepting these truths. We see this also when it's come to Mus'ab, that there's somehow an allegation that he has done something wrong, rather than people recognizing that this has been a pattern that Israel has been carrying out now for quite some time, for the past 7 weeks. It's been going into Gaza, it's been abducting people, and without anybody knowing where their whereabouts are. We've seen this happen with Palestinian workers who had permits to be inside Israel, who were then not only abducted, but beaten with their torture broadcast and put up on TikTok and on Instagram. And of course, nobody even questioning the legality, the morality of doing any of those sorts of things. So the problem has been that they've gone down the path of somehow accepting the disinformation rather than questioning it, and rather than questioning this big picture of Israel, of the legality of Israel bombing a large refugee camp. The only reason that they're refugees is because Israel made them into refugees in the first place.
Can you explain more about how you're trying to get information and attention to Mossab's case right now? I mean, word is that Israel and Hamas are close to a hostage release agreement. Does this fit into that? Why is it so difficult to deal with Israel and Palestine right now? How are you able to communicate with both?
In terms of communication is near impossible, and it's near impossible because the Israelis, a little over 2 weeks ago, imposed a blackout on telecommunications inside the Gaza Strip. And not only was there a blackout imposed, but it's also been impossible for roaming to be working. So of the times that I'm able to reach friends, very dear friends who are in the Gaza Strip, it usually takes about the entire day to reach one or two friends. Communication is near impossible. And so in terms of getting the story of Mus'ab out, it's been really just trying to connect with his family, in particular his wife, getting information, and then trying to spread it as wide as possible to friends, who people who know him, who've worked with him, his publisher, the people who have published him in the past, not just his book publisher, but others, and trying to get that information going so that people recognize that it isn't just the story of Mus'ab, but it's the story of thousands of other Palestinians as well, and indeed millions of Palestinians who are now trapped inside the Gaza Strip. It has become near impossible, Amy, to reach people in Gaza, and it's become near impossible for them to even be able to reach the most basic things like to contact an ambulance for if once there is an Israeli bomb, to be able to contact people to remove the rubble, to be able to get to the hospital. All of this has been done under the cover of darkness, and the fact, and yet at the same time, we're watching this live, and the fact that nobody is doing anything about it speaks volumes.
I want to go back to Mus'ab Abu Toha speaking on Democracy Now! Just a few weeks ago.
Last night, my son, who is 3 years old, was sleeping, and there was that bombing in the area, and he woke up and he said, "Who did that?" And he said, "Let it stop." I mean, that was the first time he was asking me to do that, as if I was responsible for the bombing. So I have nothing to do as a father. I have nothing to do as a neighbor or as a son. We are helpless here. We have been helpless all our lives, while the United States, unfortunately, is always stepping in to support Israel.
The words of the Palestinian poet and author Mus'ab Abu Toha speaking on Democracy Now! A few weeks ago. To see the whole interview, go to democracynow.org. I also want to thank Diana Bhutu, Palestinian lawyer, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization, speaking to us from Haifa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the growing calls for a ceasefire in Gaza coming from lawmakers in Washington. On Monday, Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon became the second senator to demand a ceasefire, joining Dick Durbin of Illinois. According to one count, 42 members of Congress have now called for a ceasefire or cessation of hostilities in Israel and occupied Palestine. We're joined now by Democratic Congress member Becca Ballant of Vermont. Last week, she became the first Jewish member of Congress to call for a ceasefire. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Ballant. Thanks so much for joining us. Talk about why you've made this decision. Your senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, is not there yet, but you are. Talk about why.
So I want to be really clear, Amy, with folks who are listening and watching, that I wrote the op-ed to express to Vermonters. It was really geared towards my constituents. And I should have anticipated that it might get national attention, but I actually didn't. So I wrote it for Vermonters. And what I wanted to do was really give voice to all the things that I'd been feeling and thinking and wrestling with since the beginning of October, and wanted to articulate clearly for Vermonters what I thought needed to happen. So, you know, wanted to just lay it out there. The horrific violence has to stop. Hostages must be released. We have to end the suffering in Gaza. Palestinians and Israelis both deserve safety and security. And now more than ever, I believe that we need a true negotiated ceasefire to get to a two-state solution. And as you mentioned, both my senators here in Vermont have not yet made the call. But I know in my conversations with them that we actually want the same things. Where we differ is just in the strategy that is needed to get us there. But we all want to find a way to stop the violence, to stop the bombing. We don't want to continue to see innocent civilians, including so many children and babies, die. And I just felt that it was really important for me to articulate clearly for Vermonters all of the complexity I was holding. And I honestly, when we released the op-ed, I was very focused on how my constituents would feel about what I said. And I didn't anticipate that I was the first Jewish member of Congress to call specifically for a negotiated ceasefire, because I know we've been saying a lot of the same things for weeks. So what I do know is there are no exact words right now that will sum up the totality of what we are all thinking and feeling about this situation. But I do know that we have complete agreement on an immediate cessation of hostilities, pausing the violence, ending the suffering, and trying to get to a negotiated ceasefire that will hold.
And Representative, you said that you and Representative Rashid Tlaib have been brought together by your people's suffering and are now friends. Could you talk about the vitriol directed toward her as the only Palestinian congresswoman?
Yes, I really appreciate the question. It's disgusting. The Islamophobia right now is completely and totally out of control. And I was disgusted by the fact that colleagues are trying to go after the one Palestinian American member of Congress. And as I said, you know, Rashida and I became friends early on in my tenure. We were brought together, I think, by we both have big hearts, and she's known a little bit like a mama bear in the caucus. She is very loving and gentle towards, you know, specifically new members, like making sure we have what we need. And I was really drawn to her because we are, as I said, two people that have people, you know, within our family that have endured suffering over a very long time. We're both parents to teenagers, and we share the struggles of that. And actually, I don't think it's betraying a trust to say, you know, she sent me a message last week saying what she hopes is that in the future, she and I will be able to walk together in, you know, in a true democratic Palestine and in Israel, both of us together as friends, as people who understand the horrific suffering that is going on right now. And I have really tried to use my platform and will continue to do so to stand up against the Islamophobia and also the anti-Semitism. And we've discussed this as well, that you can be critical of Israel, and you should be critical of Israel and Netanyahu and the policies. And I've never shied away from that. And I also am very uncomfortable in this moment by some of the outrageous anti-Semitism hurled at Jewish members of Congress, specifically progressive Jewish members of Congress who are trying to do the right thing and figuring out the correct strategy going forward. But, you know, Rashida will always be what I call one of my heart people.
Well, on the day after Rashida Tlaib was censured by the House of Representatives, we brought on Marion Ingram, 87-year-old Holocaust survivor, protesting outside the White House, calling for a ceasefire. And she condemned the censure of your colleague, Senator Tlaib. I want to thank you very much, Democratic Congressmember Becca Ballant of Vermont. She is the first openly LGBTQ member to represent represent Vermont in Congress, the first Congresswoman to represent Vermont, and now the first Jewish member of Congress to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. We'll link to her op-ed in the Vermont Digger, headlined "Ceasefire Needed to Stop Bloodshed in Israel-Hamas Conflict." Coming up, we go to Argentina, where the far-right political outsider Javier Milei has been elected president. He's called the Trump of Argentina. The first to congratulate him was President Trump and the former Brazilian President Bolsonaro. Back in 20 seconds.
Búsquenme donde se esconde el sol, donde exista una canción. Búsquenme a orillas del mar, besando la espuma y la sal. Búsquenme, me encontrarán en el país de la libertad. De la libertad.
En el país de la libertad, in a country of liberty, by the Argentine Leon Gieco, who signed a letter protesting Milei's erasure of the horrors of Argentina's 1976 to 1983 right-wing dictatorship that killed over 30,000 Argentinians. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Argentina, where the far-right libertarian Javier Milei has been elected president. He's been compared to Donald Trump and Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, who he won Sunday's election with 56% of the vote, defeating the centrist Peronist candidate Sergio Massa. Milei is a climate crisis denier who has proposed banning abortion, easing restrictions on guns, vowing to shut down Argentina's central bank, replacing the nation's currency with the U.S. dollar. Milei has also questioned the death toll and crimes committed by the Argentine military dictatorship from 1976 to 83. He spoke from Buenos Aires Sunday night.
La situación de Argentina es crítica.
Argentina's situation is critical. The changes our country needs are drastic. There's no room for gradualism. There's no room for tepidity. There's no room for half measures.
We go now to Buenos Aires, Argentina, where we're joined by two guests. Franco Mattaza is Director of International Relations for the Argentine Senate of the Republic. And we're going to begin with you. Can you talk about the significance of this victory? I mean, months ago, Milei was hardly known to the general population of Argentina, became famous as he carried a chainsaw with him and would use it during his speeches. Talk about the significance of that and what he represents.
Hi, Amy. Very pleased to greet you. Well, what Milei implies for Argentina today is uncertainty. He got to win the election with some promises. You mentioned one of them, and the main one is the dollarization, to change our current currency for the U.S. dollar. So he made great expectations in the population. People want to earn his salary, their salary, in dollars in the next month, and that would be impossible. So what is one of the main issues? The uncertainty and the expectations for the U.S. dollar. And the other thing that I want to underline is the human rights. We are in a country that has very deep history for the dictatorship we had. It was one of the most terrific ones in the region, and we could go over them and make justice for the victims, and the genocides are in jail now, and he wants to take them out of jail. So those are the main issues we are experiencing these days here.
And Franco Mattaza, could you talk about why the incumbent Peronist coalition, a center-left coalition, lost this election? What factors do you think contributed to that? And also, how you expect that Milei will be able to govern since he doesn't have a majority in the legislature?
Well, I think we lost because of the inflation. When one analyzes all the elections in Argentina, they always has to do with the economy. And we have a very high inflation. What did cause that inflation? Well, it began when the IMF gave us, not us, but the right-wing government of Mauricio Macri, the biggest loan in the history of IMF. They gave us $45 billion. And that's even three times the amount they are giving to Ukraine to recover from the war. And we were not in a war. Even the pandemic hasn't happened then. It was a political loan. And that make us that make our country to pay a lot of money per month. And that is extremely difficult for our economy. So we lost because of the inflation caused by the IMF. And the second question you made is very interesting because he doesn't have majority, but he has a political association with Mauricio Macri. So they will get more senates and more representatives than they have today. And that's very important because he got to win the election saying that he was the new, that he came up with new people, not the old politician, not the traditional elite. And finally, he will be part of this elite. He said today who is going to be his Ministry of Economy. And it was the same Ministry of Economy of our former president, Fernando de la Rúa, who ended with the crisis of 2001 that you might remember. And it was the same president of the Central Bank of Mauricio Macri, the previous right-wing government that lost the election with us in 2019.
I want to bring Veronica Gago into this conversation, feminist activist, researcher at the Public National Council of Research in Argentina, author of Feminist International, How to Change Everything. Can you talk about who the man who will be the new president, Milei's discourse during his campaign against feminism, against the LGBTQ community, now demanding an abortion ban in Argentina? Talk about it all.
Yes. Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me. Yes, I want to remark that Milei present himself as a novelty, but he can't get rid of the past, of the dictatorship and neoliberal agenda of the 90s. So I think that this is a very important point. Milei is an opponent of abortion rights. During the campaign, he said he was going to call for a referendum to overturn the legalization of abortion that we achieved in 2020 during the pandemic. There is a debate whether that it is possible or not, besides needing an act of Congress to call it and for the result to be binding, there is no agreement that it can be held. What is clear is that he aims to take away the legitimacy of the right to abortion. And it is also linked to the fact that abortions in Argentina are performed free of charge in public health institutions that Milei wants to privatize. Also, it is linked to his plan to ban sex education in schools, as he considers this to be propaganda for cultural Marxism and gender ideology. Again, this is a proposal against public education that he wants also to privatize. Argentina, you know, is a pioneer in the promotion of LGBTQ rights, especially in Latin America. In 2010, the country has been the first in the region to legalize equal marriage. A crucial action was also the enactment of gender identity law in 2012, which allowed people to change their gender on official documents based on self-determination. Milei speaks of these rights as privileges and has spoken out against the law that endures a job quota for trans people in the state achieved in 2021. He speaks of LGBTQ lobby, which along with the climate movement and the abortion rights, he talked about a sort of socialist agenda. And he has already said he will close the Ministry of Women, Gender and Diversity. So he has signaled the feminist and queer movement as a main enemy. And also it is very linked with the human rights movement that Franco was talking about. So I think that is, a very dark scenario for grassroots movement, for feminist organizations. But I think also that Argentina is a country with a very strong history of resistance, a very strong history of massive demonstrations. And I think that we will confront this political program.
And Veronica Gago, could you talk as well about the Milei stance on firearms in the country and also his stance on climate change?
Yes, he proposes to reduce gun restrictions. He argues that countries like the United States that have no restrictions have much less crime. This is demonstrably not true. However, it is part of making security a private matter for armed men, I think. He wants to capitalize on citizen concerns about insecurity. As Franco was saying, the inflation is our main problem nowadays. And of course, the feeling of insecurity that kind of inflation is producing in your daily life is respond with this idea of guns and security in very sexist, racist terms. So the other things that you were saying, he's a denialist of climate crisis. The climate crisis is, he says, a product of Marxist ideas. He dismisses climate change as a socialist lie, and he rejects everything that comes from that idea. Milei has an idea of extreme deregulation of markets, and that includes the necessity to deny climate change and its consequences.
And finally, the issue of the dirty war and his questioning of the number of people who died during the dictatorship from 76 to 83, Veronica.
Yes, this is completely an important issue because his vice president, Victoria Villarruel, is a denialist of state terrorism. She whitewashed genocide and also demanded the restoration of compulsory military service. She's a defender of the military accused of crimes against humanity during the dictatorship. And in doing so, both have attacked the popular consensus of human rights struggles led by the mothers and grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo, who mobilized for those disappeared during the dictatorship, and whose ongoing resistance is part of also feminist movement. So I think that this is part of our becoming struggles.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Veronica Gago is feminist activist, researcher at the Public National Council of Research in Argentina, author of Feminist International, How to Change Everything. And Franco Mattaza, director of international relations for the Argentine Senate of the Republic, both speaking to us from Buenos Aires. We'll be doing a Spanish post show and posting it on our Spanish website. You can check it out there. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Wernoff, Tarina Nadira, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sanji Lopez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.